EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Nobody wings.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
Did better than we wing it. Nothing? No. All right then. And there's our awkward intro for the week. Sorry we missed a week, folks. Life got in the way, jobs, stuff. But we're back again this week. New episode. And this week we're going to talk about a recent article. It is a new, what do they call them? Clinical practice guideline from the Wilderness Medical Society. And this one is for medical direction of search and rescue teams, right? So this is a new clinical practice guideline, which in the rest of EMS speak would be like a protocol. It's recommended stuff from the WMS because they don't officially publish protocols per se. But this was a paper that was produced talking about medical direction for search and rescue teams specifically. Several people on this paper, some of the authors we are very familiar with and know very well. And so we just want to have a little discussion about medical direction in the world of search and rescue, primarily volunteer search and rescue, as that is the biggest section of search and rescue within the United States, and where medical direction may or may not fit into that, and some of the, call it, tricky gray areas that might be found within. And with that, Mike, what do we got?
So, yeah, the paper is actually, it was published this year. I'll drop the link and all that good stuff. It's titled the Wilderness, it's not titled the anything, Wilderness Medical Society Clinical Practice Guidelines for Medical Direction of Search and Rescue Teams. As Sean mentioned, it's written by a number of folks that we know. Not putting that out there because there's a certain opinion, just putting that out there to be transparent. We know most of the authors. It was essentially convened to review evidence or practices of medical direction and how that, I'll use the term, coalesces with or intersects with medical direction. So let me just set some, I'm guessing all four people listening to this podcast already know what search and rescue is, but let me set some baselines for those of you that may not. In the United States in particular, search and rescue is it fair to say a relatively generic term, Sean, for finding and extricating people from wilderness or pseudo-wilderness areas in America that have become lost, injured, or both?
Yeah.
It is used as a definition of a team, where a search and rescue team, it is a function. Out west, it is often a sub-function of a law enforcement agency, typically the sheriff's department in many states like Nevada, Arizona. There are very few states that actually have a mandate that I know of. Out east, here in the Mid-Atlantic, it is actually a function of the Department of Emergency Management for the state. Up north, I happen to know that I believe in New Hampshire, it is a function of the it is actually a division or a duty of their conservation police department it's the game wardens that are actually responsible for search and rescue. So it's all over the map. The core understanding of the fundamental principle here is it is the location of and removal of individuals or extrication of individuals that have become lost or stranded in a wilderness environment. The penultimate agency that everyone thinks of when they think of search and rescue is the National Park Service. They were named by post-September 11th, the National Park Service was named as the SME for the federal government on search and rescue. There is a subset of search and rescue that's often talked about called urban search and rescue. Mm-hmm. That is actually it's overseen nationally and actually internationally by FEMA. There are teams typically made up of fire departments.
Yep.
That do urban search and rescue. That is much more of a geographic, or not geographic, but a natural disaster sort of event, right? Hurricanes, earthquakes, those sorts of things. You, Task Force One, FEMA Task Force One, I believe, is out of Northern Virginia. It's primarily the Fairfax County Fire Department. There's a Western Task Force, I think Los Angeles Fire Department mostly makes that one up. I can't remember.
They're mostly, the task forces come out of the major metro fire departments.
The reason I'm bringing up that subspecialty is the urban search and rescue, or USAR, as it is referred to in America, typically have agreements with and have medical practitioners on their roles. I know for a fact, one of my medical directors is a member of an Eastern USAR team. He gets deployed with them to natural events or natural emergency events, natural disasters, I should say. But they have a relatively clean-cut sort of line in the sand, right? There are medical practitioners, there's doctors, there's physician's assistants, there's nurse practitioners, there's paramedics, there's nurses that are part of these teams that are equipped and trained to go into less than ideal circumstances after a natural disaster has occurred and provide medical care. They may be operating in tents. They may be actually going out with teams and extricating people, whatever the case may be. But there's a pretty well-structured medical component. This paper really addresses the wilderness side, the non-urban search and rescue pieces. And I found a number of bits pretty interesting. First off, between Sean and I, we've been involved in search and rescue 30, 35, 40 years.
Oh, yeah, all easy.
Told, yeah. Between the two of us. Volunteers, professionally, whatever the case may be. And I think the paper is pretty accurate in that it says it's all over the map. Yeah. That's probably a nice way of putting it. But they actually mentioned that out west, in the Pacific Northwest, nearly all teams had some sort of medically trained members. But I believe the number was 34% of teams required medical training as a prerequisite for membership. So that means that just under 2/3 of search and rescue teams do not require any medical training to do, quote, search and rescue. Back when we were wee ones and way less gray, when Sean and I first met, we actually met as members of a team, and that team required first aid and CPR as the minimum criteria to become a member of a search and rescue organization. We've waxed poetic about our opinions on CPR in the wilderness setting. It's fine. But that fundamentally made us layperson first aid responders. Actually, the agency we joined at the time held a BLS medical license, but we didn't really practice medicine per se. We had some members that were EMTs. I became an EMT. You re-became an EMT. But it wasn't a focus of the organization. The focus was really to do the finding, so to speak. We spent a lot of time working on land navigation and carrying heavy crap long distances over crappy trails.
Yeah.
To include humans, but we didn't focus on medicine. I find it interesting that, according to the paper, less than half of the agencies, or was it believe it's 34%, according to the paper, 34% of teams require medical training as a prerequisite, but 77% report that they've provided patient care alongside EMS, which means they were either assisting with or engaged in patient care in some way, manner, shape, or form. Now, why the hell is this important? Why does it really matter? Again, I'm keeping this pretty general. We have international audience, one person from Sweden and then three people in America. But nonetheless, America, the regulations around medical direction, what you can do as a medical provider in America, vary from state to state. But as a general statement, I don't know of any states that allow for a paramedic, an EMT, an advanced EMT, even a nurse, to independently practice medicine without some sort of medical oversight. In other words, I need a relationship, directly or indirectly, with some sort of person that has a license to practice medicine in order to perform my duties as a paramedic in whatever setting I'm in. That gives me pause, right? There's a lot of people doing a lot of care that may not be formally affiliated. And again, different states are different. For example, Pennsylvania is a statewide medical protocol state, right? All of the protocols for paramedics, pre-hospital care are the same throughout all of Pennsylvania. They have state medical directors. Virginia is an agency by agency. It's actually not even driven in the region. Like, each jurisdiction can have a different medical director with a different set of protocols and a different set of rules that they operate under. But it always comes back to some sort of, I'll call it a contractual or understood relationship between your agency, yourself, and your medical director to allow you to perform medical activities, perform care under their oversight and under their licensure as an independent practitioner of medicine. So there, it feels to me like there's a bit of a gap. I'll pause there, Sean. I've been yapping.
Yeah, all right. To toss a few of my things in there. Yeah, so again, for those that do listen internationally, or even those in the U.S. who don't fully grasp how this works. So for the international folks, you got to remember, we're not like Britain where we have the National Health Service. We have 50 separate states and territories, and every one of them is independent, right? We have this whole states' rights piece, and it all trickles down from there. As Mike put out, like, certain states have statewide protocols that every EMS provider, regardless of where you work within that particular state, you follow the same guidelines and rules. And then there are other places like where we are, where every jurisdiction, we are broken down by regions, but even within those regions, I will say there are region generic sets of protocols. And then your specific medical director can make modifications and changes to that to suit your particular jurisdictional needs. And then mine is one of those, right? We use the baseline local jurisdiction or council's recommended protocols. And then we have several adaptions and modifications that our medical director wants us to do that are separate from the others. And across those 50 states, search and rescue is not a standardized thing, right? There are some places, as Mike alluded to earlier, particularly out west, the sheriff's departments run the search and rescue teams. And so they'll be composed of a small cadre of sheriff's deputies and a larger populace of volunteers who come in and do that. But they all fall under the cognizance of that sheriff's department. And then you come out east here, and the vast majority of all the volunteer search and rescue teams are just purely civilian volunteer teams who go and support what is known as the authority having jurisdiction, which is normally, in most places, still a law enforcement agency of some flavor, still often a sheriff's department. But that depends, mm-hmm. right? Now you have purely civilian personnel interacting with a, we'll say, law enforcement leadership. And even, and out here where Mike and I are at, the civilians are basically running the entire show. There might be one or two representatives of those, the authority having jurisdiction, the AHJ. There might only be one or two of those there that's coordinating the official law enforcement piece. And that varies depending on what the search is for and why. And so all the planning and operations and everything else is run by the volunteer crowd. And then when you get into that, we found them and they now require some sort of first aid, medical care. That's the gray area that this paper is trying to get at. Whereas, as Mike mentioned in the USAR piece, they deploy with a physician, and this, for all intents and purposes, that is their doctor, their medical director. And everybody on that team follows this set of protocols authorized by him. And it's perfect. They're their own self-contained thing. But for a SAR team, like in our area, we used to have memorandums of agreement between states. So you might be based out of one state and respond to a search in another state. Now you're in a different state, so licensure and medical practice changes. And that's what some of this paper, not really, they don't really get into that, but they definitely start talking about if you're going to be providing care under that umbrella of a duty to act, then you should have some sort of oversight and guidance by a physician. And even if you remain what we'll call at the first aider level, being a non-certified, not in a organized EMS fashion, you should still have some sort of guidance and oversight by a physician to make sure that you guys aren't going out there and just starting to provide random rogue care based on a class you took 2 years ago someplace else that allows you to, or that taught you to do some things that simply civilians who aren't licensed actual medical practitioners should be doing. Right. So if you attended a tactical medicine course and you learned how to do a needle chest decompression as a layperson, that's probably not something you just want to start swinging needles at people's chests as a SAR first responder, right? Unless you're covered under a whole EMS thing, right? So there needs to be some sort of accountability. I think at the end of the day is what this paper is really driving at, is an accountability of the type and the level of care being provided by these various SAR teams.
And yeah, there's a reference in the paper to a survey of non-National Park Service affiliated SAR teams in the Pacific Northwest, or the Pacific West, I believe. And the survey basically came back with there's a bunch of people with training and they provide care, but then less than half the teams reported having medical direction or oversight, which, if you remember what I said when I started my earlier rant, the way the medical system is set up in America, you have to have a medical director to provide oversight and guidance for your practitioner of medicine. In America, we have a concept of offline medical control and online medical control, meaning I have written set of protocols I'm allowed to execute independently based on my medical skill set and release to perform activities. And then online medical control being I'm on the actual a radio or a telephone with a doctor having a conversation and executing their orders at the time of care. I don't know of any places, and look, if anybody out there does know of places, I'm in, like, send us a note. I don't know of anywhere in America where they're like, yeah, you passed your paramedic exam, you're cut loose to do whatever you think is right. It just doesn't work that way. So it's interesting to me, if nothing else. I won't quite get into my opinions on it, but I think there's a lot of room for improvement. I will fully admit that the number of critically injured people is probably not that high. We've talked, I mentioned it earlier, we've talked before about our opinion of CPR in the backcountry and slinging a bunch of cardiac meds and doing a bunch of fancy pants stuff. It does happen. It does occur. But the large majority of wilderness injuries are orthopedic or their exposure. It's just the nature of, you go off into the woods and you get lost and you either get hurt or you get lost and you end up cold or hot or wet or hungry and maybe a broken ankle. There are specialized team and specialized geographies that have the risk of more advanced problems. The Grand Canyon deals with all sorts of Grand Canyon specific things. But again, that's mostly heat exhaustion for the most part. Right? They have advanced capabilities to look at blood values and things to provide appropriate care for the patient. But at the end of the day, it still falls in the environmental or the broken ankle space for the most part. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be operating under the same set of rules that we would have on a quote unquote street truck. That you want to help is laudable. But one, there's a liability aspect. Two, there's a should you really be doing that aspect? And I don't know what the right answer is. But to your example earlier, Sean, like just because you took a TCCC course or a TEMS course and you got taught how to needle decompress somebody's chest doesn't mean you should be slinging catheters, poking people on the regular just because you got taught how to do it. Right? They're two fundamentally different things. That so was, I guess I'm going to go ahead.
You remember when I first came to this R team and we were sitting there in class one night training and they were talking about on missions, make sure that if you're providing care, you stay within the things you've been trained to do. And I actually had to like, I need to clarify that because it's in my prior life, I was trained to do a lot of things that simply don't occur outside of the paramedic level. And it was like one of those, yeah, cool. I'm a wellness first responder and you want me to do what? And they're like, oh, wait, yeah, never mind. Wait, we said that wrong. And I'm like, okay, let's make sure we clarify that because that's how you're going to get somebody that's going to go out there and do something that's inappropriate or they aren't really, we'll say, certified to do, even though they might have been physically trained how to do it in a 30-minute class somewhere. But I think this,
yeah, a more applicable, like realistic guideline is probably there are places where quote unquote BLS providers, EMTs are allowed to start IVs.
Oh yeah. Lots of places.
And provide fluid, right? That doesn't mean that because you were taught how to start an IV once, you should be slinging fluid because yeah. Without a medical director that says that's a good idea, you probably should not be performing that activity.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it works.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I think this is probably a good segue into one of the key areas that you and I discussed a couple of weeks ago when this first came out. And that is but Mike, if I'm just a wellness first aid guy or wellness first responder, or I've got my Red Cross basic first aid 4-hour class, and I'm on a SAR team, and I go to provide first aid for somebody that was lost or injured, am I not a good Samaritan? Am I not just covered by that? Why do I need a doctor?
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, Sean.
Because this is where it gets sketchy and interesting.
It gets fuzzy. I actually highlighted, let me find the spot in the paper here. I highlighted this. Before I go into that, I do generally agree that they recommend that to ensure medically sound practice and advising on current best practices, SAR teams should be trained in out-of-hospital medicine, licensed to practice medicine in the jurisdiction where the team operates, and maintain knowledge of current best practices. I think it is a little hard, and look, guys, Doc Davis et al., see what I did there? Look, I have the utmost respect for you guys, and I think you're pushing the envelope in the right direction. I think it is probably difficult in all arenas to find medical directors that are going to have a wilderness knowledge base to them. And I do think medical oversight is important. I think finding medical directors like that are engaged in the wilderness world for every given jurisdiction, right? Like, where my boys at?
Yeah.
I know you guys like to play in the woods and be outside. I'm in. Finding a medical director for every aspect of the jurisdictional regulations that oftentimes SAR boundaries and SAR jurisdictions follow law enforcement structure, not medical structure. It may be difficult to find a medical director that is totally in tune with wilderness aspects, but I do think we need to push hard, and as an industry of, I'll call it, fledgling wilderness medical professionals, move toward having medical directors that have some sort of knowledge of environmental long-term care aspects that we've talked about on this podcast. It's why we started it. Anyway, that was an aside. Back to the topic at hand. Good Samaritan. So I think the paper is pretty clear. I think you could be reasonably argued, and I ain't no lawyer, but if there's an attorney listening, I think if you are in, let me put this in layman's terms. There's a concept of a layperson coming upon an accident and providing the best care they can versus someone that was dispatched to or was sent to a car accident. And the rules are different. As a general rule of thumb, very slightly state by state, but even as a paramedic in the state I live in, if I come upon an accident, I don't have a duty to act. But if I do act, I have to act within the rules or the boundaries. Basically, I'm only allowed to provide BLS level care because I'm not operating within my jurisdiction with a release from my medical director that says I'm allowed to do the things I can do as a paramedic on a truck on duty performing care. But I'm acting in good faith. I'm being a good Samaritan. If I have been dispatched to an event, and I'm talking front country street EMS here. If I am dispatched to an event, I cannot say, I don't think I want to go to that call, or that dude is clearly an AFib, but I think I'm largely going to ignore it and let him wave and just walk away, or talk him into waving and being like, dude, I know you passed out twice, but I haven't eaten breakfast yet and I want to punch out. So if you just sign here, that'd be great. That is dereliction of duty at a basic level. I think there's a strong argument to be made that if you are putting your hand up and being called by a governmental agency to come provide assistance, I'm not sure that you get to show up, find them, and be like, cool, dog. I'm going to try to splint this thing, but I got no medical training. I've got no medical oversight. And I hope I don't do more harm than good in the process of providing what I think is appropriate care. And also, I'm going to decompress your chest because I heard that's going to help. That's probably not good Samaritan, right? I think they make a good argument. That's probably not good Samaritan care.
No, I agree with you there. If you're part of an organized, and I'm talking, you are part of an organized search and rescue team, whether paid or volunteer, and you have been activated through whatever system you use, like where Mike and I are at, the state's Office of Emergency Management activates and requests certain SAR resources based on jurisdictions and whatever. And you respond to that, and then you are out in the field participating as a member of a search and rescue team under an official government agency, whether that's law enforcement or something else, to render assistance to those who are lost or injured in the woods. Yeah, I think your Good Samaritan thing is out the window. And that's where I think, and I totally get where they're at. I think, I won't say it's a bridge too far, but I love it. It's a very lofty goal. I think we should get there. But having that medical oversight so that everybody on your team, whether you require a basic first aid class, like the fundamentals of bleeding control and splinting, or you mandate wilderness first aid, wellness first responder, whatever it might be. And we're going to leave out official EMS things during this discussion, I think.
I'm not.
We'll get to that, but that's 99% of the podcast, man. You should have some sort of medical oversight. And ideally, that should certainly be a physician, right? That's going to provide you current best practices as far as splinting and wound management and things like that, and things you should or shouldn't do based on, you attended a wilderness first responder course and they taught you how to do sutures. That's great. If you're in deep remote Alaska and you're not going to see anybody for 6 weeks. But if you're in your average SAR situation in the US, you're going to be a few hours, maybe overnight. There's no reason for you to start stitching people up because they've got a good laceration.
Sounds like fun though.
Or if you're going to start even handing out just OTC meds, right? There are some, even the OTC level, some meds interact with other people's prescription meds that may or may not be a good idea. Are you checking to see if here's some Motrin, this is good for you. And maybe they didn't, maybe they're a tourist from a different country and they didn't know what Motrin was or Tylenol for that matter, because in the UK, paracetamol is Tylenol here in the US, right? Tylenol's being the a brand name, but
no medication is inert. Otherwise they wouldn't be medications, right? Right. Normal saline is technically a medication. It's regulated in America. Like you cannot go buy it on Amazon. It's insane, right?
You can for your dog. So it's good.
You can for your dog.
Yeah. And so I believe there should definitely be some sort of medical oversight and training just for a, if you do have a requirement to provide any level of first aid care, you should make sure that you're doing what is the current and best practice for that type of care, whether that's splinting or basic wound management. Environmental care, as Mike mentioned, whether it's hot or cold, somewhere in between, et cetera. You should know what current best practices are for the treatment of all those things at that basic foundational level. And if you don't, and if you're going off what you learned in the Navy and the Boy Scouts 20 years ago, man, like you can be way out of date and you're like trying to give people like salt packets in a water bottle, like actual table salt. It's like, this is what we used to do back in the Army in 68. Dude, that is so
we still do
on, right? Nope, we don't do that. Stop. And if you are doing that, please stop. And when I used to teach wellness first aid on the regular, you would have guys in class that would be like, oh man, when I was in the Navy or when I was an Eagle Scout in 78. Yeah, dude, no, that's over.
That's not what we do now.
That's been gone for a very long time. And so there absolutely should be some sort of medical oversight, making sure that you are doing the right things. At the SAR team, Mike and I, we were at previously, after the doctor that used to be involved decided he was no longer going to be a medical director and the EMS license went away, the next closest thing we got was an active paramedic who simply tried to make sure that everybody was staying up to date with their basic first aid skills. And is that enough? Maybe. Maybe not. Could he certainly run training and make sure that your wellness first aiders and wellness first responders are up to date, current, and they're when you hold training for medical stuff, do they know how to splint? Do they know how to do stuff? Basic patient care, like when you're carrying them out of the woods, all those other episodes we've talked about, all those other things that go into the rescue piece. Yeah, it could be good enough, right? Is he a physician providing direct oversight in that manner? No, but at least it's somebody that's got a higher certification level, hopefully that's active and current themselves, providing a little bit of something, right? If you can't find a doctor. It gets into a different kind of area, right? It's because as a paramedic, I'm not going to go tell a volunteer search and rescue team like, oh yeah, you can give out all the Motrin and Tylenol you want. Just maybe it fell out of your bag into their lap. I don't know, because it gets into that.
I have seen that.
Yeah. Yeah. We've all seen that, right? Especially, you know,
I'm going to put this on the rock here. If you wanted to pick it up and put it in your mouth, that is your choice.
Yeah, it might help you feel better later, right?
I'm helping.
Yeah. So things like that do happen. And so there's certainly that aspect that you really want to be careful of. And that's why obviously preferred choice would be a physician. And then I would say if you could find like a nurse practitioner or a PA, somebody that's authorized as an independent practitioner, I think those would be certainly, in my opinion, excellent adjuncts for that thing. Because I think one thing we got to remember too is for most of these search and rescue teams, they're all volunteer. They don't make money. And so being able to pay a physician to provide any sort of medical oversight is tricky. So you got to find one of those motivated doctors that really enjoys hiking and everything else, and maybe wants to be a part of the team and say, hey, doc, would you mind also being our medical director? and explain what that means and tell them like, hey, we're not looking to be an EMS agency, but we want to make sure that we'll run by our training and our we'll call them, just for lack of a better term, protocols of the things that we mm-hmm. want to be our people to be able to do. And is this good with you? And he can provide some oversight, help supervise some of the training, et cetera. So I'm on board, but I think,
yeah, I know in particular in the state we live in, like that is a non-option. There's a really clear structure where you get licensed by the state oversight body and you have a medical director and there are rules.
Yeah, see, this comes back
to the Good Samaritan thing, right? If you're being called to go do a job, are you under using a more broad general aspect? Are you a responding agency or not?
Well,
and if you're responders, do you qualify as an emergency response under the state law? It's an interesting question.
Well,
I don't know what the answer is, but.
And that's why I say this is where it gets that weird gray fuzzy area, right? Because you might be an official responder as a SAR team member, but you're not necessarily an organized pre-hospital emergency medical services provider. Right now, mm-hmm. I agree that the Good Samaritan piece goes out the window regardless, right? But that's mm-hmm. when you were talking about, because like wellness first aid, wellness first responder, all those common SAR certifications for medical stuff, they're not nationally recognized, right? They have a standardized curriculum,
yeah.
right? But there's no licensure, right? There's no state recognizes a wilderness first aider as a pre-hospital medical provider level, right? You're not going to get a state license as a wilderness first aider. A couple of states used to recognize wilderness first responder. I don't know if that's the case anymore, but those were out west states that would recognize wellness first mm-hmm. responder. And so that's where you're getting into that weird gray, because you're not necessarily responding as a pre-hospital emergency medical agency. You're responding as a SAR organization. And medical is often implied within that moniker under the rescue piece. But it's not, it's official. I guess it depends on your where you're at in your jurisdiction, how you define search and rescue, what the and rescue means. Because a lot of places, that's yeah. the we carried you out of the woods piece.
Which I think we're quickly falling under the, to extrapolate or go further from where their paper ends. I think there's a lot of legal gray area in how things are defined by state regulations that probably need a little clarity that would provide directional guidance to a number of agencies, right?
Yeah, and that's, and I'm not a big fan of more legislation and stuff, but certainly defining what is expected of a SAR team as a responder, an official responder in some capacity, what is it they mm-hmm. are expected to be able to perform and at what level? And if mm-hmm. you say it's just first aid, I would still think you need some sort of definition as to what does that mean?
Yeah, you could adopt the American Red Cross or whatever yeah. definition of.
Right? Yeah.
But that actually leads to my, this is going to be contentious. Whatever, it's my podcast. I take exception to Woofer and Wilderness EMT and all of those things. And I always have, and you've known me a long time, and I've always taken exception to them, not because I think they suck, but because there's no governing body. And I think it was Cruncho who said on his podcast not long ago, accreditation went a long way to improve paramedic education,
mm-hmm.
right? There's zero accreditation and zero adoption and regulatory oversight for any of these wilderness medical training entities.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they teach bad material. Bob's Woofer class is a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And we're in the business of providing appropriate, timely, modern, driven medical care to those in need. We are not in the business of doing this because it's fun. It might be fun. It might be a calling. Whatever reason it is that you do what you do as a volunteer or as a paid SAR individual, awesome. At the end of the day, the priority is the patient, and the patient deserves appropriate care. And I think if there were to be a first step, figuring out a way to provide, hell man, I don't think the registry would have any interest in this, but there's no reason there couldn't be a wilderness edition of a registry EMT course that would actually have some oversight and some accreditation. Well, I don't know. I don't know how to solve for that. Here's the other bit, though. Yeah. And I'll let you muddle that one. I don't think this is a national problem. And I think for the most part, the folks that play ball in the wilderness game treat it as a national problem. I think this is regional. I think this is state-based. I think this is even regionalized within a state, and individual states have to figure out what is best for them.
Yeah. No,
I think the right thing to do is bring light to the problem and then figure out ways to handle this on a state-by-state basis. The medical knowledge and the medical care needed in the Pacific Northwest is not the same as the medical care needed in Florida. It's just not. And the rules need to follow the requirement of care. Urban EMS, you can argue it's different in different regions, right? Like, I'm guessing paramedics in Maine see a lot more frostbite than paramedics in Florida. But in general, paramedicine is largely structured, right?
Yeah.
With regional specialties. And maybe we think about it that way. I've heard of some individuals, not the folks that wrote the paper, but there are individuals that want to see wilderness medical standards nationwide. It doesn't make any sense.
Not well. And that goes back to Sean's big thing of, tell me what something wilderness medicine is.
You know, I mean,
there's just medicine, right? Like Chicago, you thinking a doctor in downtown Chicago in the ED doesn't see frostbite and hypothermia in January, February?
Yeah.
Oh, is he a wilderness medicine guy? No, he's just a fucking doctor, right? Environmental stuff is part of, well, it's part of all curriculum, EMT medicine. And above,
yeah,
depending on levels. But yeah, you might gain some more additional nuanced knowledge on how to better care for and treat those things at the upper levels as you go up in the actual wilderness specialty areas, right? Take your WPC for paramedics or your FOM or all of your various things that physicians have access to as well, which I think I like that there's a lot of physician programs that are growing out there that take students out for a summer semester and expose them to some wilderness stuff. It's good stuff. But yeah, having a national wilderness thing, it's like, yeah, what you need in Alaska, in the remote places out in, by Denali and places, yeah, vice what you need in southern Arizona. Yes, environment. For sure, both sides, both get cold. One gets balls hot. One warms up a bit and gets nice and temperate and lovely. They're like, trying to say that we need a common standard across the board. Yeah, no, that's not going to work. This country is way too big for that. Which again, it's, yeah, come on, let's. What are you going to do with that?
It sounds like you vehemently agree.
Yeah. It's, you know me, I'm not a fan of all these wilderness certs because 99.999% of them, they're not measuring your ability to provide care in these wilderness and austere settings, right? It's, again, most of these classes, especially the classes you go to, I think there's a couple, I know there's a couple exceptions, one or two of them you and I have been to. Right. Where it goes into that whole sticks and duct tape and building litters out of ski poles and backpack frames. Great, guys, but
I'm out.
Stop. But like, that's some Boy Scout level shit. Like, for the rest of us adults that practice pre-hospital medicine, holy crap, bring a fucking litter. But anyway, take your 6 ounce Sam Splint and put it in your goddamn backpack. Stop. And right. I get, like we've talked about this a million
right
times.
Now,
there is a time and
place. I just wanted to end on you saying, put your damn Sam Splint in your backpack.
Yes. Right. And again, there's a time and place to improvise care and things you don't have, but it should be because you're out of the things that you brought and there's just way more patients than you're expecting. And again,
but doesn't that come back to the definition of a good Samaritan?
And it would. And at the same time, but see, I brought this, we talked about this in the episode, we talked about this improvisation bullshit. If I've attended a wilderness first aid class and I've been taught how to use a SAM splint and how to do an appropriate sling and swath and everything else, and I catch you using climbing cordage and a broken ski pole and something else, fuck you, you're wrong. Why did you not have an appropriate first aid kit? I don't care if you're hiking with your family, by yourself, or with a canoeing club, right? Have the proper first aid kit, like seriously. And then if you are just randomly, trail running, I'll give you an excuse, because you're in your Ranger panties and your water bottle and you're hauling down the trail and you find some guy that fell and broke a leg. Sure, I then give you permission to use sticks and weird stuff you found. But if you're, anyway, that's enough of that. So back to the topic at hand.
I agree though.
I think oversight of the SAR teams in the medical care that they are going to provide or are expected to provide. And I think that expectation should certainly be identified first. What does this state, this county, whatever, expect of its SAR members, regardless of paid, unpaid status? Okay, we are expected to be able to provide these foundational first aid services, basic bleeding control, wound care, and splinting, and then basics of environmental exposures, hot or cold, whatever. Note, there should be, if there's an expectation to provide airway management to be able to BVM somebody, okay, that takes on a whole different level. And maybe now you need to have different certifications. And maybe you need to maybe start looking at, do your SAR teams need to have an EMS license or fall under a medical director? Maybe Joe Bob's Super Mountain Rescue Squad does not necessarily itself have an EMS license, but the overarching jurisdiction says if you're an EMT or above, you have a, we'll call it an actual pre-hospital EMS license or a wellness first aid or whatever, even wellness first aid, and you come on these sanctioned SAR events, these are your standing orders. And maybe there's a physician or somebody that's going to serve as that medical oversight, and you can call him if you have questions, just like we would with online medical. But I think that the first thing is, again, like you said, 50 states and territories, right, in this country alone. You can't make a generic, Northern California is going to have the same thing as Southern California, right? The Mojave and the Sierras are not the same. Same thing going from West Coast to East Coast, North, South, everywhere in between. Our state and the states North, South, and West of us. Yeah, sure. We can pretty much all play the Mid-Atlantic game. Similar regions, similar terrain, everything else. But there's going to be nuances. So if I respond to a SAR in a different state because it's still just a 4-hour drive away, do the rules change there? Or am I still covered under this aspect, right? There's a lot of stuff that goes into that, right?
We used to go to a lot of different states.
Oh, yeah.
And it was always unclear.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, again, I totally agree with the paper and the direction they're going with it. And I think whenever feasible, yeah, absolutely. SAR team should have some sort of medical oversight. Do I think every SAR team needs to become an EMS agency with EMTs and above with a full on set of protocols and a very active involved medical director? I think that's a bridge too far. And if we suddenly said that's the standard, you'd lose 90% of your SAR teams. Oh, come on. Don't even deny that one. If you in this state suddenly said every member of that conference
with the end result, but I think the definition of engaged
is at different levels, right?
Could use some clarity, right? Like I'll just say it right now. I think every SAR team that is going to provide anything above first aid level care needs a medical director and they need standards.
Because then they're providing above medical care and that puts them into an EMS agency realm. And that is a whole different thing. Yes, 100%.
But if they're doing first aid, probably not. the gray area that I don't think has been adjudicated yet is whether or not they're layperson responders, which I found very interesting from the paper. In fact, you and I debated it when I first read it a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I got you all fired up. It's fun.
Yeah, you're an asshole. It's an interesting question, because if you've been sent to go do a job, are you a lay responder? And I think the answer is probably no, but I don't know that there's, I don't know of any court cases where that's actually been argued over. So I don't know.
Yeah. See, and I think that's one of those gray areas. Yes, you had a duty to act because you were part of an organized search and rescue team that was requested by some government agency that was overseen by another government entity, whether that's state, local, whatever. And then you provided some level of care, and again, medically speaking, and things went bad. You did something wrong, or maybe you did everything right, but an infection set in and they lost a limb, like just an extreme case. Right? And they want to come back and sue the man who put that bandage on. So, hey, like, I'm not a certified EMS provider, man. I was just there as a good-natured responder.
I didn't know what I was doing. I was just trying to help out, man.
Yeah, so... that's a very good question. Man, this question will probably not get answered till at least where we're at, that we're aware of, one of those court cases pops up, as with so many things. Like, nobody cares until somebody dies, and then let's make some legislation to figure it out.
And then everybody cares.
Yeah. And for all we know, there's other states that are out here. It's a pretty large country. May have already established these rules. Hey, maybe you're in Wyoming and you're part of a SAR team. This is the standard. This is what you can and cannot do, kind of stuff. And it's already laid out somewhere else. That could be a case. We just don't know, because some of these things are incredibly difficult to find when they're done at the local levels and things like that.
Plus, we haven't looked very hard. So there's
And yeah, to be honest, I don't care enough to look into it. I just found this topic to be very interesting. I think it was a pretty interesting and well-done paper, but something we wanted to talk about at the end of the day. Like,
Doc, it doesn't impact, like, I'm willing to help you and me in capacity I can. I think it is something that needs more work and thought and effort, both from a appropriate care perspective and from a coverage and ensuring that someone at some point is not arbitrarily hampered or hammered by trying to do the right thing and ends up in court in a bad way.
Yeah. That's about that.
Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up, Sean?
No, I think just look at my highlighted notes real quick, see if there's anything else within. Yeah, I think, and one of the things that know throughout this is at the end of all these big things, there's like noted as a strong recommendation, but low quality evidence. For those that are into papers and analysis, right? That's like, just like Mike and I said, like, yeah, we agree that there probably should be some sort of adult supervision at some level to make sure that people are doing the right thing, providing the best care possible. But finding the evidence to support that is tricky, right? Because again, my quick cursory search did not lead to a lot of court cases where wellness first aiders or below, right, provided such horrible care that there were lawsuits and tragic things occurred following care. Right. Yeah. So yeah, it's difficult to find the evidence that says we should do this. But I think if you look at it from the lens of an experienced SAR responder, pre-hospital medical provider, yeah, this is definitely an area that probably could stand to do some other research in. That'll be tricky to collect that data, because that's like teams having to self-report some stuff. And who knows what you're going to get that one.
We'd use NIMSIS. It collects data.
Yeah, from SAR teams that don't enter stuff into it.
Hey, maybe the first step is just to get them to do charts.
There you go. Get a bunch of SAR wellness first responders doing ESO. Whatever charts.
Yeah, man.
Zoll and stuff.
I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is.
I think we know
data collection requires input.
So. Yeah, that's the thing, right? So I think that's something people need to take into account when they read this paper is you should read this paper and go, okay, yeah, a lot of that makes sense. It's probably a good idea. Might be difficult to implement in a lot of places, depending on level involvement of the community on both sides, whether it's physician or the SAR teams. And yeah, just say, yeah, I mean, fair. It is what it is. But I think overall, it's going in the right direction. And I don't think I could legitimately say, oh yeah, it's all horseshit and we should definitely not have any sort of medical oversight professionalism within the SAR community. That's just, I couldn't say that with a straight face. And maybe it would be different.
No, I think that's right.
If it wasn't you and I having provided at ALS level stuff for so many years now under that whole organized physician directed pre-hospital EMS model. We've been out of the SAR game for a long time. If we were just members of a SAR team still, we might have a different view.
Yeah,
we don't need anybody to tell us how to do good care. Maybe you do.
Yeah, it's a good point. I don't know what the right answer to that one is, but
yeah,
we have been out of the game for a little while. All right, we've been rambling for almost an hour. Again, like normal. Had half a plan. We rambled about a bunch of stuff.
I had one rant.
If you have any comments or whatever, send us a note. I know there's a lot of folks that do search or rescue that listen to us. By a lot, I mean like 10. I'd like to hear your opinion. Doc Davis, Doc Hawkins, if you guys want to come on the podcast and talk about this with us, David, you're welcome to join us. I don't know if you guys listen to us at all, but we know you guys. I'd like to hear from you directly. Maybe I'll just reach out, but it seems like a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting paper. I recommend everyone read it, especially if you're in the wilderness game or you're a member of a SAR team.
Oh yeah. You certainly should.
It generates a lot of good thought. I don't know what the right answer is off the top of my head, but I don't think there's an answer, but I think it is something that needs to be discussed and worked through. All right. With that, I think I'll hit the stop button now.
Godspeed.
All right. Peace. If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us, and until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.